Welcome to the Cutting Through the Matrix book club. My name's Adam, and today I'll be joined with David, or by David, I should say. And we are going to be continuing on the series that Melissa and Darren have started on the book Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. I don't think the audience needs any introduction to the book or anything like that. We'll be covering the fourth chapter entitled The Buffer Fringe. I will just go off right off the bat now and say that I have not read the book cover to cover. I'm not sure that many people have. It's a book that I bought years and years ago, probably 10, 15 years ago when I started listening to Alan Watt. And I just used it as a reference book. And being quite busy recently, I didn't have time to read through the chapter. So all you're going to get from me really is just my notes, a few sort of basic notes, having listened to the audiobook chapter of it. So that's where I'm coming from. But David, what's your story on this? Have you read the entire book, or have you just read this chapter, or what?
I actually printed the book out. I don't know where I got it from, but a PDF from probably the dark web somewhere about 10 years ago.
When
Alan first mentioned it. Right. I actually destroyed a printer trying to print the whole thing out.
It's like 1,300 pages or something. Right?
1,300 pages, yeah. I wasn't too popular at work. I did read all of it, but a lot of it's sort of gone in one ear and out the other.
It is
like we were saying just before we recorded, it is quite a dry book.
It's a very dry book, and I mean,
yeah,
that in and of itself is something interesting to note, because there's so many of these globalist types, you know, the various academics and philanthropists who write in a style which is so incredibly dry and boring. But
yeah,
as Alan would often joke, you know, you'd sort of be reading through these dry political books and then just be falling asleep, and then something amazing is said, or something totally outrageous or revelatory, and you wake up all of a sudden. And a lot of them are like that.
Right.
And this one is no exception, I would say. I've gone through that whole chapter on audiobook, and there's so much of it is just your standard Masonic history. It's just dates and wars and treaties and isms, and it's just he's rattling off one thing after the other, you know. So it is. I've forgotten a lot of it too, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's easily forgettable because it's sort of just data.
Yeah.
But I mean, what's first on your list of notes on this chapter?
I think the first thing I wanted to mention really was that Carol Quigley has got a very annoying way of looking at some of these countries that a part of the buffer fringe. Mm-hmm. I mean, he refers to the Boer people as rural, backward, Bible-reading, racist minority. And he also refers to the Turks as that as well. It has been mentioned in the book club that he is something of an Anglophile.
Oh, I mean, that comes through all of it. Yeah. Total Anglophile. Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. But I mean, he's also got I also think he's got quite a twisted view of how the British Empire worked.
Yeah. Well, you wonder how much of that is spin and how much of that he really believes, because I mean,
that's right.
You're never quite sure, because he's talking a lot about people like Cecil Rhodes, you know,
yes,
and the establishment of the roundtable groups and all of the industrialist activity in Africa and all of that. And he's talking about this guy as if he's some kind of messianic figure, you know, whose only real failing was that he was so committed to these utopian philanthropic causes that he adopted what he calls questionable strategies in his pursuit, you know. So that in itself is, I mean, okay, he's talking about the guy who started the organization for whom he is the official historian. So, I mean,
yeah,
he's not going to speak badly of him, but he himself, to be sure, is an Anglophile, and yeah, that comes through in so much of his own, so much of his comments in that chapter.
Yes, it's interesting you say the Masonic history. That's interesting. I mean, I've never been a Mason myself. I've always found it quite a strange thing, to be honest.
It is, and I mean, naturally, neither am I. But that's what I call Masonic history, because it's lionizing the British Empire and these sort of that whole system of economics and culture.
Yes.
And it's, you know, again, we're talking about wars and treaties and economics and the encapsulation of broad and complex dynamics into these kind of like condensed linguistic things, you know, isms and ologies and this That's group right, and that yeah. group. And it's all very, everything he's putting, everything, he's categorizing everything very, 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 very rigidly according to his particular worldview. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're out there, him and his ilk are out there saving the planet. They're really raising the savages up to the level of the white man and all of his intellectual superiority, you know. And
yeah.
again,
yeah.
it seems that he really believes that, or at least he feels that way about it. You know?
Yeah, I think he actually does believe it.
Yeah,
it is interesting. The bit that got me was where he says much of the British Empire was acquired by private individuals and commercial firms and was taken later by the British government. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, they were crown corporations. You're telling me the monarchy weren't involved?
Yeah.
I mean, King Henry VIII was having people beheaded left, right and centre. He had his wives beheaded. I mean... anybody who tried to go against, say, the East India Company would have been beheaded. I mean...
Well, there you go. This is the Masonic history once again.
Yeah.
I mean, no, you're never going to hear that in a book like this, are you?
No. I was a little bit disappointed that there wasn't more of that kind of thing in it. Yeah, and his view of the Boer people, I mean, calling them backward...
You know what? Well, it just reminded me of something there. One thing that he mentioned, he uses the term nationalism in a particularly disparaging way.
Yes.
In this whole chapter.
Yes.
He keeps on talking about it. And it's just that word nationalism. And let's go back now. This is 1960s when this book was written. So
yes.
Think about where we're at now and how that term has been dirtied and sullied over the last 10 to 20 years or so. And we think of that as being something that's fairly recent in history, that there's been this negative association with the word nationalism. You know,
yes.
This
yeah.
is for Trump people and all that stuff, you know?
That's right, yeah.
But then you go back to this book, written in the early 1960s, and he's got that same, he's putting that same attitude out there. Like, nationalism is backwards, and people who are into nationalism are backwards. So, I mean,
yes,
so he's, what he's telling you really through that entire chapter is that he himself and the people whom he represents essentially are internationalists. You know,
yes.
They're empire builders.
Yes.
And the whole book, the whole chapter is just talking about basically how they're building that empire across Europe and Asia and basically the struggles and the challenges they're in.
Yeah.
So I found that. Yeah, just that word again, when we think about it being, in today's context and think, well, it's even back then, that's the perspective that they had about it, you know?
Yes, it reminds me of the book, The Open Conspiracy, which is very similar themed in terms of all the things we hear about today with globalism, really. The borders are bad, nationalism's bad.
That was H.G. Wells, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, right. I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with it because Alan talked about it so often. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I managed to get hold of a copy of that. That was more blatant in terms of how he spoke about the so-called little people.
Right, yeah.
Mr. Everyman, they like to call them.
Poor unfortunates.
Yeah. I mean, Carol Quigley, to me, I mean... I think it would be interesting to hear him speak in private, really, and see what he really thinks.
Well, I think you get maybe a little bit of that at various points throughout the book. There's also, well, there's that famous interview that he did. And I think it was in the early 70s. It might have been.
Yes.
I think it was on the Telegram channel.
Yes, we've had that on the channel. Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting one because he's
he's quite open in that.
He's a little bit more open. There's still spin in it though, which is quite interesting, and you're sort of wondering. Yeah, it's like the guy's talking out of both sides of his mouth or something, because they're talking about secret societies and, you know, the CFR and Chatham House, and then they sort of, this is kind of linked into, well, you know, are these groups all around the world? Is it Masonry? Or I can't remember exactly how the conversation goes, but on one hand, Quigley's sort of he's admitting that these groups exist. That they absolutely do exist and they operate secretly. But on the other hand, he's sort of trying to play it down and poo-poo it as if like, oh, well, it's not like, you know, it's not like some kind of spooky secret society or anything like that. And so he's sort of saying on one hand, yes, it's real, but on the other, it's not, or it's nothing to worry about, or it's nothing. Yeah, it feels like it's a game or something, or spin.
Yeah. I do have a keen interest in history, but some of it, I wasn't too familiar with. I mean, I wasn't too familiar with the Ottoman Empire.
Neither was I, no.
No. But more recently, I think what happened post-World War II, I'm more familiar with. So it's kind of filled in the background to what happened before, which I did find of some interest about the Young Turks, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the YouTube channel called The Young Turks.
Yeah, with this crazy nutcase, Ugo, or whatever his name is.
That's right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that name. I don't know anything about it really, though, to be honest.
Yeah, one of my favorite videos on YouTube is where they have a meltdown when Donald Trump won.
Right, yeah.
that's quite funny.
Yeah.
The actual Young Turks movement, I mean, there was a lot of violence involved, really, but the gist of it was they were unhappy with the way the government was censoring people, and got together and supposedly tried to overcome that. What I've been looking at is the recent war in Yugoslavia and how it relates to what Quigley was talking about.
Go ahead, please do tell. Because I'm ignorant on that, so I'd be interested to hear what you have to say.
Well, post-war in Yugoslavia, the ruler was called Tito, and he was a communist. And he died in 1980, and after that, the International Monetary Fund came in and basically bankrupted the country. So there was a lot of unrest in the 1980s, and that kind of led, similar to how, I mean, Tony Blair compared Slobodan Milosevic to Hitler.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of thing as the Weimar Republic of the hyperinflation and the same kind of economic scenario that led up to the conflict. There's actually six republics that comprised the former Yugoslavia. The main atrocities happened in Kosovo and Bosnia with the Muslim Albanians. The collapse of the Communist Party happened in 1990, and in 1991, Slovenia, which was one of the republics, had a 10-day war, and they gained independence, and that was kind of it for them after that. But the Serbs and the Croats really didn't get on very well, and Slobodan Milosevic was basically the leader of the Serbs, and in 1993, Bill Clinton got involved, and he put sanctions against the Serbs because they were trying to basically take over Bosnia and Croatia. And that culminated in NATO doing airstrikes in 1993. The Kosovan Liberation Army was trained by the West, and in 1998, NATO started doing airstrikes on Slobodan Milosevic's heartland. I don't know if you remember the siege of Sarajevo and things like that at the time.
Not particularly. This is all very vague. I mean, vague memories only. Yeah.
Well, I did find an article about Tony Blair where he said, you better give me a note on it, starting with, where is it?
Right. Yeah. Oh, you mentioned that in an email.
He didn't even know where it was.
Right.
And he very much a parallel to what we were talking about of Carol Quigley's attitude towards the sort of kind of backwards people. Tony Blair said, this is no longer a war. This is a battle between good and evil, between civilization and those who don't know how to hold a civilization.
Wow, right. I can see where you're drawing the parallels there, because we hear the same sort of refrain from Quigley throughout that chapter.
Yes.
Because it's pretty much exactly how he talks about everywhere outside of the colonies, really.
Yes.
So, yeah, interesting. But they especially he talks about India, actually.
That's right, yeah.
He talked a lot about Indian culture, and that they were trying to bring the Indians up into a civilized way of life through teaching them to read, making them literate, and giving them higher education. But for the problem was is that so many of them really didn't buy into it, weren't interested in it. They had a much less materialistic focus in life. You know, the various different religions of India, obviously, a lot of them, they're not materialistic, you know.
Yes,
And he really made it quite clear how he felt about all that.
On the book club channel on Telegram, we've actually been recently discussing the sort of native black population of South Africa and how well they integrate with a civilized first world kind of country. Apparently, I mean, obviously you can't tar everybody with the same brush, but anecdotally from the book club, we've learned that, you know, maybe they don't do that well in what we call a civilized kind of society with, you know, running water and that kind of thing. Maybe they do prefer the sort of village way of life. I can see that there would be some truth to that. I mean, I've never been there myself, but sorry, what were you going to say about Alan?
You know, it just reminded me, because Alan talked about this a lot, you know, the presumption that the Western, what it really is, it's an economic model. It's a system, because you don't just get running water and power and education for nothing. You get a system of money. You get money and loans with interest, lots of interest.
Yes.
And all kinds of bonds that you've got to give up, and typically in the past, religion, so Christianity, you know.
Yes.
That's maybe not so much the case anymore, but yeah, that was not something, you know. Quigley makes the assumption that this was the ideal, essentially, and that any sane culture that was worth anything should have been happy to adopt it.
Yes. You know? Yeah.
That's how I feel. That's what I'm reading in that chapter, at least anyway. You know.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so he's complaining about other racists. You know, when I wonder, yeah. I wonder if it's actually him, really. So.
Yeah. I've always found it quite funny to do with the war in Yugoslavia. I mean, the Russian troops were on the ground there as well, and they actually took over an airport with, you know, sort of going against NATO's orders.
Right.
And that almost kicked off World War III.
Okay, did not know that.
It's funny, really. Alan always mentioned the sort of wag the dog type of thing, where how much of the news that we get is really true. And I did find that this story that James Blunt, the singer, averted World War III.
When did this come? This has popped up across my radar already. I don't know. Yeah, was this to do with?
Yeah, he was in the armed forces at the time, and he got an order from the General Wesley Clark to attack the Russians at Pristina Airport and to take over the airport for NATO. And General Jackson, the NATO, he refused to do it. Basically, James Blunt was the captain at the time. He refused to do it, and he would have been court-martialed, but he was backed up by General Jackson of NATO, apparently. So this is the headline is that James Blunt averted World War III.
Yeah, I mean,
it does remind
it's very
me
creative.
It does remind me of the scene in Wag the Dog where they get Willie Nelson to do the song.
Well, I mean, as soon as you started talking, what's this, the Willie Nelson song again? I'm trying to remember which one it is. Sitting in the studio. Is it the blues one? Yeah.
Yeah. Scratchy.
Okay, yes.
You ready?
Yeah. With an old label, I see where you're going with this.
Oh, shoot.
Hey, good old shoe. Good old shoe.
Stand up straight and tall the way he taught you to.
I'll write a speech.
I'll help you with the speech. Good.
Mm, heartfelt.
Touching.
Touching. Oh, people will weep.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you started talking about that situation in Yugoslavia, I was just reminded, obviously, of the film Wag the Dog. You know? I mean, again, yeah, I'm still pretty ignorant about that whole area of the world, post-Soviet, you know, post-satellite states and all of that conflict. But
It was basically Catholics against Muslims and against Eastern Orthodox Church. The religion came into it a lot, which I think is the case in Ukraine at the moment.
There's another Wag the Dog story, which I don't know what to believe about that, to be honest with you.
Some of the footage I've seen of like where the missiles are supposed to have hit the buildings, it just doesn't look convincing to me.
They say, I mean, I think the idea that, I think they put the idea out there pretty well that, oh, there is no war at all. I think that's deliberately put out there to force people from one extreme to the other. But
something's going on,
I think, clearly, but what? Because think about other wars that we've seen in the past. You know, we think about when we went into Afghanistan right after 9/11, or when we went into Iraq. You have never seen anything so televised as those invasions.
The shock and awe campaigns.
Exactly. And that could be part of it. But you get footage of bombs and of things blowing up and of carnage and of things being blown to pieces. You get real tangible carnage and catastrophe when there's a real war on. You know
that's
what I mean?
Right.
I've not seen any of that in the Ukraine.
No.
It's blurry footage taken at night of nondescript locations that could be anywhere at any time. And then, of course, then these photographs of so-called bombed civilian areas, which just don't look right. Things don't add up. And so you're wondering, you know, it does make you wonder what the hell is really going on there.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, we've got the Gaza situation.
I'll be honest with you. I tuned out deliberately.
Yeah.
I saw some headlines. I saw some clips and I thought we are now entering an era of psychological warfare that we have not seen yet. In terms of what they are prepared to do and show on television. And I thought, this is not safe for human consumption anymore.
Yeah.
Because I'm watching people around me who are watching this stuff and they're freaking out. They are losing their sanity. You know what I mean? So I stayed right back. I mean, I absolutely, of course, it goes without saying. I mean, it's that the human catastrophe, the human fallout there is disgusting and it's horrific. You know, I'm not going to.
Yeah,
10, but still, we've been given a dialectic to fall into there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got to join one team or the other.
Yeah,
you know, and it is so emotionally charged and so graphic and so horrific.
Yeah,
I my gut just tells me to stay away.
Yeah,
for now, because I don't think you'll be able to make any sense of it. And I think it's meant to be that way.
You can't go on Twitter and say that. Both sides are at fault.
Yeah, can't do that.
You've either got to pick one or the other. I mean, there always is the assertion that Israel created Hamas and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the West created these, the West created ISIS, the West created Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
How do we really know, you know, sort of how that went down? Well, we don't really know how that went down. But I believe that there's so many sort of double agents and double crossing going on that you wouldn't know how are we ever supposed to know.
That's the thing, and that's exactly the point I was just making. You know, there's
yes.
I don't think that we are so far beyond any ability to make clear sense of who's who and what's what, that it's almost not worth it. I mean, we know where it's going. We know what the purpose of war is. And I think a lot of it is just, a lot of the information we're getting is just to confuse us, nothing more.
Yes.
And demoralize us. So.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else to say on the Yugoslavia situation at all as it relates to the book chapter, or did you have something, any other notes that you were thinking about?
Just really how what got me was how the IMF basically started it. And the same's happened in India. So we're talking about the buffer fringe countries. The same's happened, I believe, in South Africa as well with the IMF.
Right, yeah, of course.
That just seems to be the modern format of how they bring the countries down.
Yeah, this is the common theme throughout the whole chapter. I mean, Gregory's talking about all of these countries. He's talking about the political conflicts, the economic problems, all the different cultures, sectarianism.
Yes.
And he'll talk about the geology, the resources of places, religion, you name it. He's giving you a very, very broad overview. But the consistent thing is that he keeps talking about the basically Anglophiles like himself, Rhodes, the elites of the British Empire, being these wonderful internationalist philanthropists who simply want to lift all these countries up. And actually, what's happening is that they're destroying them. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
They strip them of their own national culture.
Yes. You know,
and they put them into a system of debt and control, and they call it something else. Of course, they talk about we're giving them education and civilization and whatever it happens to be. We're bringing them up to our level because we're doing God's work. Blah blah blah. All the usual stuff. You know, but actually, it's subversion on every level.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's consistent across time. You see this pattern towards unification, amalgamation of economic, cultural takeover. I mean, you know, it ebbs and flows, but it continues to push forward in the same direction over a massive long period of time. That tells you like how big this agenda is.
It just comes down to sort of stripping the assets, just doing what they want with the country. The water is a big thing now. The cobalt and things for the batteries.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course.
It's all still going on now. And I've always found it interesting that we had a bit of a discussion on the Telegram channel about the Rothschilds. I never hear them mentioned. They never got mentioned at school. And, I mean, they've played quite a big role in British history, really, to say the least.
It's funny. They actually came from Hamburg, which is not far away from where I am, about just an hour outside of Hamburg.
So that's right, yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting culture down there, man. Some high society Germany is living there in Hamburg.
Right.
The banking elite, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not short of money.
No, not at all.
There must be some nice cars driving around.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Right, I've sort of, rubbed shoulders with a couple of these types. Nobody famous, I'm sure, but you get a feel for it.
Yeah.
I had something on my mind I just wanted to get onto, and now I've forgotten it. I don't think it's written down, but where were we? What was I talking about? I think it's just the integration, the way that this thing works itself, this agenda and this ideology works itself forward so consistently.
Mm.
You know, over time and over so many different countries, so many different ways. It's like, it's so big. I think the bigness of it is what I'm getting at,
agenda. To be fair, it's quite impressive, really.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
How they do it and sort of not all fall out with each other. But when that amount of money is involved, they don't want to risk it, do they?
Well, I think you do. There will be disagreements from time to time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there will be infighting, but it's over the details. The ideology never changes.
No, that's right.
The ideology is always the same, and it's, of course, the consolidation of power. And you know, if they can't, yeah, they will find ways to. They put it this way, they have enough. There's enough mutual interest on the part of the elite to keep them working together.
So, yes. Yeah.
Very strategic. In fact, that's what it reminded me of. Actually, it was, you know, Kissinger died recently. Henry Kissinger.
Yes.
And people were talking a lot about his legacy and his him being so famous for this concept called Realpolitik. You know. So
yes.
Politics that are beyond partisan lines, that are beyond any particular left or right ideology. Just simply what is practical, what is effective and efficient. You know. Using any politics necessary to achieve the goal, no matter what. It's funny, when you're reading Quigley, if you read between the lines, I get a lot of that as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Because he's talking about all these different characters, about different cultures, different countries, and all the particulars of the religious and ideological and political circumstances. And again, when we look at, well, what's actually happening? It's consolidation of power. He himself is representing a group who are purely strategic in many ways. You know, I don't think people like Cecil Rhodes. You know, I mean, are we supposed to believe that he was a real philanthropist, that he really cared about people, that he really,
I mean? Yeah.
I think like all the other people of that ilk. Bill Gates, we've got Bill Gates today. I mean, these people are doing philanthropy work as a cover, and,
yes.
because it's strategically useful to do so. No other reason.
Yeah, I mean, they think nothing of a vaccine that sterilizes people.
No, exactly. Yeah, no, it's the same. It's the same with, you know, John D. Rockefeller. You know, he was one of the first big magnates to really, really get smart with the whole idea of public relations.
Yes.
And getting people, getting the working class on side by, you know, pretending to do philanthropic work.
Absolutely.
That's all it ever was. You know, it was a pretense. It was strategically useful. You know, so I see a lot of that in the chapter as well. So, I mean,
yes.
He can talk about it. They can talk about their godly morals as much as they like, but they'll do whatever's useful.
Yeah.
You
know. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
What else have we got here? Here's something. I'll mention it now because just in case I forget it later.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the chapter, he's talking about China.
Yes.
In the Far East, and he's one of the things which I found fascinating is that he talks about how he's talking about ancient Chinese culture. It was very inefficient. They have massive population, but they're they've got a totally dysfunctional bureaucracy. They make bad use of their working class. They make bad use of the resources of their land, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But also he said that it was quite normal in Chinese culture for a very long time for them to basically accept corruption as something that's quite healthy and normal. Like they didn't have any moral objection to it.
Right.
I'm not sure if you noticed that bit or if you...
Yes, yeah.
You did?
I know what you're saying. What did we do? We set up the British Opium Company and flooded the place with opium, got them all hooked on that. I mean, it's not really much of an improvement.
You know what you can talk about. If you've got anything more to say on that topic, I'd be interested to hear it. Because I did know that the British royals, at least the predecessors to the current royals, were the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family.
That's right. Yes.
And they were doing the opium trade.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The Royal British Opium Company.
Yeah.
And they still do now. I mean, that was a big part of the Afghanistan war.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We went straight to the opium fields there and had the soldiers guarding it for them. It was interesting. I went to there's a place called the Eden Project in England, which is like a biodome, a sort of big,
right.
like a big greenhouse, basically, and they had the royal crop of opium on site there. So I think they are partial to probably smoking it as well.
Not be surprised.
I can imagine Prince Harry and Meghan partaking in that.
Wouldn't be surprised,
So, I mean, what a way to infiltrate China. I mean, I don't think the Chinese are ever going to forgive us for that.
Well, here's what I found interesting. He says that they had no moral objection to corruption. They accepted it as part of life. So there was no outrage or indignity about it. It was kind of normal to them. And he says until the early 20th century, when the British Empire started making inroads there and started, in his view, elevating their culture. To the standard of these Western virtues, which he claims that they were all spouting, And I wonder, I mean, of course we know, that's bullshit, but, it's interesting because it's like, 50 years later, we have the Chinese Cultural Revolution with Mao Zedong, and it's like, well, were they planting the seeds of that?
I don't know that.
I mean, you think about that, right? Get them. You've got a country that's with massive economic potential. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a fantastic, basically testing ground for social experimentation in the same way that Russia was.
Yes.
But in which they could take it off in a different direction and do slightly different things with it. And it's like, well, was that what they were doing? Were they bringing in a sense of human rights? A sense of aspiring to these Western ideals, just so in a few decades' time, they were sowing the seeds of a revolution.
Yes.
Basically. I'm wondering if that's what I get reading between the lines when Quigley's talking about that, is that they were importing the Western values not to elevate the Chinese, but to get them angry so that they would have a communist revolution. And go on to take up that role in the world,
Yes, I think we've been doing that in the Middle East as well.
Okay.
The Western culture, sort of.
Well, Iran for sure.
Iran, yeah, definitely Iran.
Without question.
Yeah.
That was, I tell you, I remember back in 2009, it was a very, very interesting year. Very, very interesting year. Three big topics in 2009 on the news that I just remember distinctly. Number one was the swine flu thing.
Oh, yeah.
We can get into that on another day. But, I mean, yeah, I think that was testing for COVID. That was the,
Yes.
Dress rehearsal, if you ask me.
Definitely.
But then the second thing was the Iranian Revolution and Twitter. So all of a sudden, Twitter is on the news every day. So there's your...
It was, Luna. Yeah.
Since when is social media private company getting free promotion every single night on the news? There's your first clue.
The BBC, I mean, suddenly every presenter had their Twitter handle at the bottom of the screen all at the same time.
Yeah,
every news channel had their Twitter handle at the bottom of the screen. Hashtag this, hashtag that.
Yeah, exactly. And they were talking about how the Iranian Revolution. The secularist uprising, shall we call it? I don't know what you want to call it, was being enabled and helped along the way by Twitter. You had these two stories basically being presented together. I remember that very, very vividly. It's amazing now. I mean, they've obviously been wanting to go into Iran or sort that problem, get Iran out of the way for a long time. And there's always been a lot of debate and discussion about how exactly they should do that. We'll call it Which Path to Persia is one of their project names, like the CFR types. And it's interesting because now that we've got the Israel situation or the Palestine situation again and the whole situation with Hamas and Hezbollah and whether Iran is supporting them or to what extent they are.
That's been mentioned an awful lot on the news. Iran backed this, Iran backed that.
So they're back in the spotlight, and now, of course, we're getting these all these stories about what it's like to be a woman in Iran and Iranian female DJs and the underground feminist scene. You want to talk about this reads like a it's got CIA written all over it, you know.
I mean, there's another group called Queers for Palestine.
Oh yeah, I keep hearing that. I don't even know what it is, but
yeah, they keep having protests where they've got the Palestinian flag and, you know, like a gay pride parade with the Palestinian flag.
Right.
And people are saying, you know, if you went to live there, they'd get thrown off a building. You know, it's a bit not very compatible.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we're at now, isn't it? Really, sort of pick you to whatever fashionable current causes, link them together, and start a group and get lots of funding. So
yeah.
But you know what? I'm just going to go back to the topic before because I had another memory. So something just reminded me of something as well on China, right?
Yeah.
And about how that was, you know, I was wondering about whether that was setting them up basically or building that revolutionary culture for the future. I actually went through China recently. I flew to New Zealand over Christmas for a holiday. This where it's where I was born. And we decided to do a stop halfway because it's a bloody long flight, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not getting any younger. And I thought, yeah, we'll stop in China then and we'll do a sleep and then get back on the plane and do the rest of it. And I mean, so I didn't go into China per se. I mean, the hotel wasn't just in the airport. But man, even then, even just going into China at all was an eye opener.
Right.
And you will see what communism a few generations in looks like.
Yeah.
What a fully totalitarian state looks like a few generations in. It's scary stuff, man.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I mean, you've got, I don't know how many times I had to be scanned just to get through customs and security on the way in.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you just go through so many machines. One's doing, they're checking your temperature. Then they do a face scan. They do an eyeball scan. Then you've got to get a ticket from a machine and take it to a desk. And then they do a fingerprint scan and another on and on and on. And what I realized actually after going through a few of these was that actually a lot of them are just for show. They're not even functional.
Right.
It's theater.
Yeah.
It's not all theater, but a lot of it is literally theater. They've got these fake little looking machines that don't even do anything. All they're doing is getting people to walk through what looks like a metal detector.
Yeah.
It's not doing anything. It's just to remind you that you're in a, it's just to remind you where you are and who's boss.
Yeah.
And when you see people, you just see like dozens and hundreds of people all yabbering on their phones, doing video calls, totally unconsciously just being herded like sheep. This is I think the first time I've actually, we talk about sheep and sheeple and all the rest of it, but you know, when you go to China, you will see people literally like sheep being herded
by
the dozens.
You felt it there, yeah.
You see it there. They are told through this gate, through there, scan this, you know, push that, you know, take your jacket off, put your bag on the x-ray, whatever.
Yeah.
With no resistance whatsoever.
That's pretty creepy stuff.
And, you know, we've got dozens and dozens of security cameras for every square meter of that airport.
Yeah. They're
just everywhere. You know, all the airport people, of course, they were wearing military boots and everyone's wearing face masks. It was pretty scary.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's your, there's the fruition of all the stuff we've been talking about, basically.
That's right, yeah. It really freaks me out about the social credit score system and where you see these videos where they've got the vending machines where it's scanning the face and, you know, whether they've been if they've been up to no good on social media, they're not allowed to get a drink out of the vending machine and all this kind of thing. I think it will come here, but I don't think it will be that bad. I'm always a bit more optimistic, but I'm probably a bit naive. You never know, do you?
Well, what I have found in my experience is that these things, they are on the way in, but they're never in the way that you think they'll be. They take some things are more immediate. Some things take a longer time, and they tend to come in at weird angles. You know, we're always focused on the most obvious. We're always focused on what appears to be coming directly at us, and often that appears to be an illusion. And yeah. Meanwhile, some other version of it that is kind of camouflaged and a bit confusing and it sort of throws you off. Meanwhile, that's going to come at you from out of left field, and you haven't really noticed it. And it isn't as bad maybe as you thought it was going to be, but it's still bad enough. But at the same time, you're getting used to it.
Yeah.
It's not such a big shock. You know, I think they play a lot of games with perception.
Yeah.
When they bring in a lot of these controversial types of policies, you know, there's a lot of perception games going on with that stuff.
Yeah. Well, having said that, I mean, we did go through, we had all the COVID nonsense. I mean.
Oh boy.
That's it. I wasn't surprised by how people went along with it, but it was disheartening.
You weren't surprised? Okay.
No.
That's interesting.
Like you say about the swine flu, though, I mean, it's been coming.
The groundwork was going well.
Yeah, I do remember that in 2009.
When it came, I was thrown off by it, was not expecting it.
Right.
So I was a bit confused for the first month or so, not quite sure what to make of it.
Yeah.
And I think, but after about a month or so, I was, okay, I know for sure what this is, what we're dealing with now, what it's about. But I probably was still a little surprised at how many people went along with it. I think because what I saw was the people that I was spending time with at the very beginning, when we first went into all those lockdowns, and people were just kind of hanging out, and the rules were they were sort of a bit unclear and a bit loose, and everyone was just kind of hanging out with friends at home. I remember that.
Yeah.
A lot of people I was spending time with were quite skeptical and confused, and people were asking questions right at the very earliest stages. There were people were like, this doesn't make any sense. What?
Yeah.
You know? And what got me is when those people eventually went under. You know, and that surprised me, I think.
I wasn't surprised, to be honest. I think it was Darren who said on one of the talks that he actually thought it was going to be like a really deadly disease, and it just didn't materialise. I can relate to that. The first images that were coming from China with the people falling down on the street and all that nonsense. I mean, that did not materialise in England.
Well, since when is a respiratory virus made you drop
on
your face when you're walking down the street? I mean, I didn't buy that for a second.
No.
You know? I thought it was one of the things that made me realise pretty early on. I was like, okie dokie, right? Yeah. I think I know what it is.
Well, I mean, I've worked in the my employment background's in the health industry and care sector.
Okay.
I wasn't employed at the time, but I would have lost my job for not taking the vaccine. So, I mean, that was the worst thing about it, really, people losing their jobs for not taking them, that thing.
Yep, I lost the job. I lost friends. I refused to do it. No, I got fired. And I lost a lot of friends, a lot of people.
Yeah.
But man, am I glad I didn't, you know?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I had people freaking out on me in public, screaming, crying, histrionics, you name it. For real. Yeah. Crazy. Totally crazy. Trying to stay calm through all of that, man. It was
But it's kind of as if it never happened there, if you know what I mean.
It is.
It's kind of all just gone back to normal as if it never happened. I mean, is the virus just gone now?
Yeah, I tell you what's interesting here in Germany is that they're doing damage control now. And for years that was infamous. That was totally like out of the question. You know, everybody, we've got to have solidarity. We're not going to talk about the fallout. We're going to just do this and be tough and we're going to have lockdowns and mandates and it's for the best. And now on the radio every day, I'm forced to listen to a lot of radio at work.
Yeah.
And the constant topic now is how basically society and the economy is in such bad shape now, as opposed to how it used to be before COVID.
Yeah.
And of course, there's no accountability. Don't get me wrong. There's absolutely zero accountability or analysis of like what has actually happened. It's all the usual standard political. Oh, you know, mistakes were made and we could have done better in this area and we could have been quicker here and a bit sort of more efficient there. And anyway,
yeah.
Nothing
yeah.
to see here. Yeah. Usual stuff. But the fact that they're bringing it up a lot, I don't think that if things have gone back to normal, I think that there's an appearance of normalcy, but underneath it is an air of surrealness or something.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
There's something lurking below the surface, if you ask me.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't, I don't know what it is, but it doesn't feel normal.
No.
You're right, I know what you're saying. It does. It appears on many levels that as if it never happened. I do understand that part of it.
Yeah.
But I still have this sense sometimes when I walk around outside that we are now living in the ruins of what once was, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's done damage, and the damage isn't always visible. Yeah,
pretty crazy time. I was like everybody else. I was devastated when Alan passed away. But I mean, thank God that we could still listen to him while that was going on. I know that grounded me a lot.
Oh, absolutely. That was my sanity in so many ways, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
The when he started doing like the 4 and 5 hour talks, it was very calming and peaceful for me to listen to. So I'm thankful that we had that.
So am I, and I'm thankful that we still have this now. Thanks to Melissa and Darren.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
All the other people have contributed towards keeping the site going and helping with new content and all of that.
That's right, Yeah, Melissa's done a great job.
And it occurred to me that we've just gone past the anniversary.
That's right, yeah.
And that was last week. It's sad. I won't get into all that, but it's one of the good things is how much, what a rich legacy he left behind him.
That's right, yeah.
He's still here with us in so many ways. There's so much, I mean, I've been listening to Alan Watt for coming up for 15 years now, and there's still talks that I've never heard. I can still find something I've never heard one way or the other.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think I have heard everyone, but you don't always take it in, do you?
Or perhaps it's that then, you know. Perhaps it's maybe you have heard it, but it's been so long. But
yeah,
you can't remember it. We are coming up for about an hour now, David.
Yeah.
I think I'm pretty well through most of the little notes that I've made here.
Yeah, me too.
On this
yeah.
chapter, you as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess to recap, I think my sort of what I take away from that was it's very dry. It's a lot like your standard Masonic history. There's a lot of dates and. You know, and sort of really encapsulated things, everything sort of listed and very tight and contained. But also, you got a question, who was speaking? Who's doing the talk? Who is this man who's talking and who are the people he's talking about? Who are they really?
Yeah.
What's the real story being told here? Because within all of that dry history and all of these dates and names and places, you are being told the story of system. Yeah.
And these people,
it's a system and agenda that is bigger even than the people that he's talking about in this book.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It's bigger than even that, than Rhodes and Milner. So, I mean, that's just the level that we can see.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's what I got out of that.
I mean, I would recommend that people, if people haven't read it or listened to the audio book, it probably is worth it. And obviously, there's a reason that Alan mentioned it so often. He does sort of let the cat out of the bag a few times.
Yeah.
I think perhaps not so much in the Buffer Fringe section, but definitely later on in the book he does. As the book club continues, perhaps the next people who get to speak on it will have some more sort of juicy topics to get into.
Yeah, I think perhaps you're right, and we did draw the short straw on this one because it is a dry one, you know. And I certainly know that I would have definitely enjoyed having done some of the later chapters that I'm a little bit more familiar with. But look, I'm looking forward to whoever steps up next.
Yes.
Yeah. And hearing what they've got to say on the next chapter, and I'm very happy that we've got this thing going. So.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, should we wrap it up then, David?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So, thanks for coming on, and thanks for everybody out there who's listening. Thanks to Melissa and Darren. And look, we're looking forward to whoever does the next one. We should definitely keep this book club idea going. I think even once Tragedy and Hope's been done, I've even got some ideas for some other books that people could start on as well. So let's keep it going.
But absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me, David.
Yeah. Thank you. God bless.
Later. Okay.
Good.
Heartfelt.
Touching.
Touching. Oh, people will weep.
Might even get to heaven in the soul of a